Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Today's business leaders are saying that sustainability and diversity metrics are key to the way they do business. But what does that look like in practice? Stick around until the end of this episode to hear more.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakraborty, and this is On Point. When it comes to Chinese cuisine, there is so much variety between regions that you really have to think of it as a whole world of food, not just one national cuisine. When you go to a Chinese restaurant, though, here in the U.S., you may not even know you're eating Cantonese, Taiwanese, Shandong, or Jiangsu cuisine. But then there's Sichuan cooking. Many of you know it as hot and spicy, but my guest today says, yes, it has that kick, but it's also one of the most subtle, layered cuisines that China has to offer. So this hour on Point, discovering or rediscovering the bold delights of Sichuanese cuisine. And you can join us. We want to hear from everybody, but especially from listeners who might hail from Sichuan province. And if you're from other parts of China, call us too. Do you admire Sichuanese cuisine? And how do you rate Chinese restaurants here in the United States? Are we finally beginning to see a greater diversity of authentic Sichuanese food here in the U.S.? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Now, the reason why we're having this conversation is because I'm joined today in the studio by Fuchsia Dunlop. She is a chef, an award-winning author, and her books on Chinese cooking have been bestsellers even in China itself. She's the winner of 4 James Beard Awards and has been shortlisted or nominated for 4 more. And her latest book is called The Food of Sichuan. And if you go to onpointradio.org, you can read the introduction there and, better yet, find 3 recipes out of the book. So Fuchsia Dunlop, welcome to you.
Hello.
So since this is glorious radio, people can't see you sitting across the table from me, but I'd like to let everyone know that you do not originally hail from China.
No, I grew up in Oxford, England.
Yes. So how is it that a good British girl ends up becoming a famed writer and chef of Sichuanese cooking?
Well, I always loved cooking as a child, and I always wanted to do something with food. And after I graduated from university, I had a job where I was just sub-editing all this material about East Asia, and particularly China.
For the BBC.
Yes, for the BBC. And so I went off to China backpacking, knowing nothing about the country, and was immediately fascinated. So I went back to London, signed on for Mandarin evening classes, and to cut a long story short, I ended up winning a scholarship to study in China. And I chose Sichuan province partly because I'd had the most spectacular lunch there a year before.
The power of food.
The power of food. And I just knew it would be a wonderful place to live.
So let me ask you, this was in the 1990s.
Yes, I went there in 1994.
94. Okay, so before we get to sort of the transformative experience you had in learning all about the cuisine in China, what was the Chinese food scene like in London or in the UK at the time?
Well, I think rather like American Chinese food at the time, it was very much dominated by the Cantonese style, but adapted to Western tastes. So sure, you could get some authentic Chinese food, but if it was, it was Cantonese. But otherwise, for most British people at the time, Chinese food meant sweet and sour pork balls and egg fried rice and a very limited repertoire, really, and not representative of the cuisine at all.
Okay, so then when you went to China and you ended up studying at a culinary institute there, first of all, tell us, what were the flavors and the experiences that you were having that opened your eyes to sort of the depth and complexity of the cuisine that you were definitely not getting in the UK?
Well, I suppose that, you know, the Cantonese style is quite mild in flavor and tends to emphasize the sort of essential taste of ingredients. But the Sichuanese chefs are just masters of the art of flavor and of combining lots of different seasonings into this multiplicity of different tastes. And so my immediate impression with Sichuanese food was that it was this dazzling variety. They say in Sichuan, 一菜一个, 白菜白味, which means each dish has its own style and 100 dishes have 100 different flavors.
Wow.
So, you know, you'd go out for lunch, and at that time I didn't have much money, was just going to little restaurants near the university, but you'd have quite sort of everyday ingredients, but this one would be very hot and spicy, this one would be a little bit sweet and spicy, this one would be sour and hot, and this one would be very mild. So it was just a very exciting cuisine and also so fresh. You know, it wasn't that sort of deep fried, you know, takeout of people's stereotypes. It was healthy and fresh and very, very lively and exciting.
Wow. Okay, so tell us then, when you went to this famed culinary institute, you were the first Westerner, the first foreigner,
yes,
and first woman?
Well, I was one of only three women, okay, in a class of 50 young Sichuanese men.
Okay. And so what was that like?
It was hilarious. I mean, you know, it was a steep learning curve because it wasn't even taught in Mandarin. It was all taught in Sichuan dialect, uh-huh, which I knew a bit from living in Chengdu, but it was full on Sichuan dialect. All our textbooks were in Chinese. And of course, there's this very sophisticated vocabulary of culinary terms, which I had to learn. And then I was, you know, surrounded by men. We cooked in teams of 10 and they were all blokes and they had never met a foreigner before and they were a little bit chauvinistic. So it was quite, in retrospect, it was an insane thing to do, but it was such fun and the cooking was so wonderful.
How did you earn their respect?
Well, I suppose that, you know, I've always been a decent cook. And when it came to the practical, to the cooking, we were all on a level. You know, we were all learning how to cook Sichuanese food. And so I managed to hold my own in the practicals. And yeah, I think I got away with it.
And I presume that your command of the Sichuanese dialect got pretty good, too.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Baptism of fire. I mean, you know.
Okay. So tell me then, when we talk about Sichuanese cuisine, As I said in the intro, for those who know it or think they know it, hot and spicy is what comes to mind. Is that a fundamental characteristic of this food?
It certainly is, in the sense that the Sichuanese people love their chilies and also the lip-tingling Sichuan pepper. So it is a spicy cuisine. And even in China, if you're going to Sichuan, people will say, "Ni pa bu pa la, are you or are you not scared of chili heat?" So they do use a lot of chili, but they use lots of different kinds of chili. So not just fresh chili, but dried chili, pickled, fermented chili oil. And they also combine the chili with all kinds of other seasonings. So you get lots of different sorts of chili flavor. And also, there are many flavors that are not hot at all. So Chinese food everywhere is all about balance. And a good Chinese meal will always have boldly flavored dishes and delicate dishes, dry dishes and soupy dishes. So you're meant to create a kind of harmony of a contrast. So in Sichuanese food, although the sort of high notes are sometimes knock your socks off spicy, you always have very lightly flavored soups and stir-fried vegetables and sort of sweet dishes as well. So it's very delightful.
You have such enthusiasm for this. It's infectious, I have to say. Okay, well, so since we're talking about spices, you have brought some here to the On Point studio. What do I have in front of me?
So that's some really good Sichuan pepper.
Okay.
And it's related to citrus, and it has this wonderful scent. So if you just open that and inhale its gorgeousness, tell me what you think.
Oh, my gosh. That is a surprise. That's amazing. I mean, it doesn't smell at all like a typical pepper. It has that.
It's completely unrelated. The normal regular pepper in Chinese is called Hujiao, barbarian pepper, because it was a later import from abroad. This is the old Chinese pepper.
Oh my gosh, that's beautiful.
And if you want to try it, it'll make your lips tingle and dance.
One of these, straight from this bottle?
Well, if you like, I suggest take one of them and put it in the front of your mouth and chew it juicily.
Just the front, where all the spice receptors are?
Yeah, and then chew it juicily twice and then take it out and wait a moment.
Just chew it twice, okay.
Yes.
On Point listeners, if I cannot talk for the rest of this hour, Fuchsia will just host the rest of the program. Okay, so chew it twice in the front.
Yes, okay. And then take it out. Now take it out and then wait, and you should get this lovely singy aroma coming.
Mmm. Yes. Oh, that's wow. It's I don't actually even know how I have to say I've never felt this or tasted this flavor, so I'm not quite sure how to even describe it.
Well, in Chinese there's a word for that sensation, ma, which means it's the same as the word for anesthesia and pins and needles.
Uh-huh.
That tingly dancey.
Uh-huh. I don't think I have a pins and needles yet, but the sort of the anesthesia maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit.
And a bit of citrusy freshness.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's the thing. It has a clean feeling to it.
Mm.
Okay. So this is a Sichuan pepper.
Sichuan pepper, yes. And the other little jar is the pepper that I just gently toasted and then ground to make a very aromatic powder that you can use as a dip for deep fried dishes or sprinkle on cooked foods.
And
so
I can,
just have a sniff.
She's looking at me like, don't inhale too much. Oh, yeah, that's lovely. Also, the roasting really has a... It kind of makes it, it brings a mellow richness to it a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that a proper description of what I just
smelled?
Okay.
And it's so
I'm not a foodie. I'm a newbie to all of this. So, do you think, you know, ingredients are so important, right? Like if I had tasted this in a Chinese restaurant, I probably would have had a completely different opinion about Chinese food that I get here in the United States.
Yeah, but to be honest, the first time I went, I tasted it was in Chongqing, Sichuanese cuisine, which they eat very spicy food. And I didn't know what Sichuan pepper was, and every dish had handfuls of it. And I found it really alarming, and I wrote in my diary that, you know, I couldn't eat the food because it made my mouth numb. And I think you need to be introduced to it by someone, and then, you know, and you don't want to use too much at first. But it's a very special note that you really don't get in other cuisines.
Mm. Do you see this particular cuisine of China, the Sichuanese cuisine, sort of coming out in the West, coming out from the shadow of Cantonese cuisine?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's really to do with patterns of immigration and fashions in China because, you know, American Chinese food was created by Cantonese immigrants. And you had, you know, some people from other parts of China, but that was the dominant style. But since the opening up of China in the 1990s, a whole lot of Chinese people from different parts of the country have come to study and live and work in the United States. And wherever they're living, whether it's, you know, in the States or back home, they want to eat the trendiest, hottest food, which is Sichuanese cuisine. And so now you have lots of Chinese restaurants, particularly in metropolitan centres in the States, which are not catering for, you know, Western taste. They are Chinese food on Chinese terms, and they are really authentic, and it's what Chinese people like to eat now.
I'm starting to get the pins and needles. A little bit from this beautiful Sichuan pepper that's been brought to our studio by Fuchsia Dunlop. She's author of The Food of Sichuan, and we're talking about this particular form of Chinese cuisine and its bold delights. We'll be back with a lot more. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. In a recent episode, Series CEO Mindy Luber says sustainability has reached a board level.
Look, if you're an agricultural company and you're not thinking about water risk, you're an apparel company, you're not thinking about risk to your cotton crop around the world. If you are a bank and not thinking about stranded assets of fossil fuels, you're not probably doing your due diligence.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the glories and delights of Sichuanese cuisine. And I'm joined today by Fuchsia Dunlop. She is a James Beard award-winning chef and writer. She's author of Land of Fish and Rice, Every Grain of Rice, Shark's Fin, and Sichuan Pepper. And she has a new book out. It's called The Food of Sichuan. And we want to hear from you. How have you seen Chinese food as it's offered here in America change in just the past couple of decades? What do you love specifically about Sichuanese cuisine? Is it that beautiful pepper, which, by the way, Fuchsia, I'm getting those slight pins and needles now on my palate from having tried that pepper. Is that what brings you to this particular cuisine of China? Now, I'm really lucky whenever we get chefs to come into the studio because you've actually brought us a dish. here as well?
I have.
What is it?
So it's Yuxiang Qieze, fish-fragrant eggplant.
Fish-fragrant eggplant.
Yes. And the curious thing about it is there's no fish in it at all, but it's one of the classic flavour combinations of Sichuanese cuisine. So it's not mala, numbing and hot, that very fiery one, but it's made with pickled chilies, ginger, garlic and scallions, and a bit of sweet and sour. And that kind of layering of different tastes is absolutely typical of Sichuanese cuisine.
Pickled chilies, ginger, garlic and scallion, and...
A bit of sweet and sour.
And a bit of sweet and sour. Okay, so let's give this a try.
Yeah. I've been waving my cleaver around in your kitchen.
Is this one of your favorites?
This is one of my favorite all-time dishes, not just in Sichuan, but anywhere.
Thank you. Okay, you keep talking and tell us about why you love this dish so much while I try. I have to say, as I'm breaking a personal rule here, usually I am not fond of eating in front of a microphone. But for your cooking, I will make an exception. So what is it about this dish that you thought was so emblematic of the greatness of Sichuanese cuisine?
The genius of Sichuanese cuisine is making the ordinary extraordinary. A humble ingredient like eggplant, using these flavoring techniques to make it into something sublime.
Okay, keep talking because this is amazing.
I don't want to eat in front of my brother. This tastes so good, though.
Yeah, it's
oh
that,
my God.
You fry the aubergines, the eggplants first, so they're kind of gorgeous and golden and buttery, and then you simmer them in this aromatic sauce, and you get all these different notes. And you can see that there's a little bit of heat there, but it's definitely not fiery hot at all, is it?
Mm-mm. Mm.
All right, let's go to a caller so I can finish this dish. Let's go to Dan, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi. Oh, wo xi huan la cai. I love spicy food. I love Sichuan. I had the opportunity to live in Shanghai in the late 90s, got out to Chengdu. When I came back to the States in 2000, the thing I craved the most from my experience in China was Sichuan cuisine. I could not locate the places where I could get the authentic dishes. You know, the mapo tofu, the dandan minqiao. I can't believe you're actually because that is just one of my favorites. I'm so glad you also had the peppers there because it is such a different kind of spice.
It is.
Such a different kind of layering. And I'm just curious from your guest, is it actually possible now for me, the home cook, to make a decent mapo tofu?
Yeah, I would say absolutely. So mapo tofu, pockmarked old woman's tofu, which is one of the great dishes of the world and a famous dish from the Sichuanese capital, Chengdu. So that dish, tofu you can get in any good Chinatown, good Chinese shop. And the key seasonings are the Sichuan chili bean paste, which is made from a special local kind of chili and fava beans, fermented and has this rich savory taste. And a few other Chinese seasonings you can get in any Chinese supermarket and the Sichuan pepper. And it is now possible to get those seasonings, authentic ones, in America. And so, yes, you can make a really good mapo tofu here.
Oh, fantastic. You see, I mean, I will always have, being a child of immigrants myself, I will always have a special place in my heart for sort of the make-do type meals from one's home country based on what you can get here. I mean, there's like a whole nother, it's a new form of cuisine that has... That has emerged over, you know, the past century because of that. But on the other hand, being able to get proper ingredients now must be feel really transformational in terms of you don't even have to go to China necessarily anymore to get this authentic experience.
Yes, and I think particularly with Sichuanese cuisine, I think it travels well because the heart and soul of Sichuanese cuisine, as I've said, is in the flavors.
Right.
So you just need a basic library of seasonings, and then you can cook whatever fresh ingredients you have to hand.
Oh, it's wonderful. Look, I finished that eggplant. You can give me some more while I bring on another caller. I'm getting greedy. Look, I'll just admit it. It tastes amazing, folks. This is one of the perks of the job. Let's go to Brian, who's calling from Portland, Maine. Brian, you're on the air.
Thank you. Future, I am one of your great fans, having read several of your books. Believe it or not, there is a Sichuan restaurant here in Portland. The couple who own it came from Chengdu, I believe. I am interested in what might be called culinary anthropology. I'm trying to track down the origins of a number of iconic ingredients in various cuisines. and certainly Sichuan cuisine has several. I would certainly like some guidance from you as to how to track down these things. Any suggestions for me?
Well, you mean in how to understand their origins and history?
Yes.
Well, I would say in my new book, I mean, I have tried to write about, I've written about the origins of the Sichuan chili bean paste and of the Sichuan pepper and of the chili in Sichuan. And the chili, of course, is a relatively recent import. And the Sichuanese still call it hai jiao, sea pepper, because of its foreign origins. So I would say one of the problems with Chinese cuisine in general is there isn't a huge amount of material available in English. Mm-hmm. But I suppose one of the things I try to do is write about it from Chinese sources.
Well, about the chili in particular, I mean, China being the nation that it is, relatively recent can mean different things. I mean, how recent was the introduction of the chili?
Oh, well, so the first chilies were seen in the coastal provinces of China, sort of late 16th century and thereabouts. But at first, they were appreciated more as an ornamental plant with these beautiful scarlet fruits and white flowers. And it was only later that their use as a food was documented. And it took a while for the chili to sort of creep inland. And it wasn't really established as a crop in Sichuan until the late 18th and early 19th century. So it's really only a couple of hundred years that you've had the chili used in Sichuanese cookery, which is surprising when you think how essential it is.
Interesting. And do you have a sense as to why in Sichuan province in particular it took hold as it did in the cuisine?
Yeah, well, I mean, the local explanation is that the climate of the Sichuan Basin is damp and muggy. And according to traditional Chinese medicine, you have to counter this unhealthy dampness by eating lots of drying, heating foods. And so before the chili, the Sichuanese had ginger, they had Sichuan pepper, they had pepper, other heaty foods. And in fact, there's a source from the 4th century describing the predilection of people from the Sichuan region for sort of flavor and spicy and pungent tastes. So it seems that there was a history of sort of bold spicing and the need in medicinal terms to have these heating foods. And then along comes the chili and it fits in perfectly.
Oh, that is absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Although it makes me wonder, I mean, people are just different in different parts of the world. Sort of a damp climate is the one where you hail from originally in the UK, but it took a while for supremely spicy foods to take a hold amongst the people of England, I'd say.
Yeah, but quite a lot of Sichuanese friends have said that Sichuanese food is perfect for a diet for English people.
Well, let's go to Ray, who's calling from Brunswick, Maine. Ray, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, and I'm going to keep eating this eggplant.
I was just going to say, every grain of rice is probably my favorite cookbook. It was a gift from my sister-in-law, and I didn't know if you could recommend, of the other books that you have, the next one to get. I'm still a beginner, but we really love the pork belly recipe, which is absolutely delicious. And we always do this mashed cucumbers and pretty basic. I don't have a ton of skills, but I didn't know which book I should get next.
Well, I think the new one, The Food of Sichuan, you would like, because if you like those flavors, there are a lot of Sichuanese flavors in every grain of rice. And although The Food of Sichuan is trying to sort of represent the region by having lots of different sorts of dish, I always try to make sure that a good proportion are easily achievable at home and very rewarding, don't need too many ingredients. So I think you'll find lots of dishes in that book that you enjoy and don't find too challenging.
How much are the recipes modified then?
From the first edition?
Yeah.
Oh, well, so Land of Plenty, my first book, was published in the States in 2003. And for this new edition, I have added 70 entirely new recipes. And I have retested every recipe in the original book. And I think they're even better.
Mm. Well, and the reason why I ask is because I think one of the main inhibitors for people who want to try to cook this at home is it does seem rather intimidating, right? Not just in terms of the ingredients that you need if you want to really get the recipe right, but even the techniques. Is Sichuanese cooking one of those very fussy technical types of cuisine?
Well, I would say that like any of the world's great cuisines, Sichuanese cuisine is very diverse and it has everything from hearty country cooking and street food to very elevated banquet cooking. So some dishes are technically challenging, but Sichuanese food is also what Sichuanese people rustle up after work, you know, every day at home. So a lot of dishes are really very simple. So what you need to do is you need to make one trip to Chinatown or to a good Chinese shop and stock up on, you know, your chilies, your chili bean paste, your Chinese vinegar, sesame oil, a few, I mean, really not very many, maybe sort of 8 to 10 different seasonings. And then you can make practically all the dishes in the book. And I think every grain of rice, so that was a previous mm-hmm. book of mine, that was meant to be a primer, you know, really going back to basics. But the same applies really with this book. We've got a picture of all the basic ingredients you need. And right. once you've got those in your larder, your pantry, then you're set to go.
Well, I want to just take a moment to talk a little bit more about your experience as a student when you were living in Chengdu here. Because in an episode of the Chinese documentary series Looking West to Chengdu, and the series profiles you, right? My guest Fuchsia Dunlop describes her life as a student at Sichuan University back in 1994.
Crawling out of bed on a damp October morning in my small shared room in the Foreign Students Building of Sichuan University, I can see a row of wutong trees and beyond them the Brocade River, where a cormorant fisherman is trying his luck in the murky water. I watch, captivated by yet another of the endlessly fascinating little events that mark my daily life in Chengdu.
That's Fuchsia Dunlop. In 1994, in Chengdu, China, it's been 25 years. Did I get that math right?
Exactly. This fall, it's 25 years. Yes.
How much has Chengdu changed?
It's sort of the change is so radical it's almost hard to describe. So when I went there, it was a city of old lanes and sort of wooden houses and tea houses and all these street vendors and old Chinese medicine shops. And it was so enchanting. And you could really see the history of China in the street life and so on. And almost all of that has been swept away by modernization. And so on the face of it, the city looks more like other Chinese city, but there's still something magic about the Chengdu atmosphere. And you still find that wherever there's a little forgotten space, some Sichuanese person will fling out a few bamboo chairs and set up a tea house. Because the Chengdu people are famous for being idle, pleasure-loving types who just enjoy drinking tea, playing mahjong, and eating delicious food. So the atmosphere of Chengdu is still very special, and so many foreigners who visit the place, as well as Chinese people from other parts of China, they fall in love with it because of this sort of this lazy charm of the life there.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. Now, has there been? I was going to use the word revitalization, but that implies that there had been an ebbing away of focus on food in Sichuan province, which did not happen. But maybe a sort of a rediscovery or kind of a change in the approach to food in Sichuan province recently.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a very, very lively and dynamic and innovative food culture. People are obsessed with food. The restaurant industry is hugely competitive. And Sichuan province has always been, as local people stress, very baorong, inclusive, open and tolerant. You only have to think of the chili, a foreign spice, totally taken to heart. And so the pace of change in food is just like wildfire. And new ingredients appear, particularly in my mind, is okra, which didn't really exist in China a few years ago and is now on every restaurant menu, often using Sichuanese seasonings. There's an extraordinary number of restaurants and little street food outlets. And with social media, Chinese people swapping tips on WeChat all the time. So it is very dynamic. Yeah.
That sounds wonderful. Let's go to Dan, who's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on the air.
Hello, Fuchsia. First, I want to thank you for introducing so many authentic recipes to a Western audience. I cooked stir fries for a long time, but really got more seriously into cooking authentic dishes because I had had them at local restaurants, which then closed. And I couldn't find another restaurant that would make them as well. So I started cooking at home, things like Sichuan green beans. And I've been able to locate, thanks in part to your books and website, some of the authentic ingredients like preserved mustard stem. But one thing I haven't been able to achieve is this thing they call wok hei or breath of the wok at home on a regular gas stove. Do you have any tips on how to approximate that? Or
Yeah, so wok hei is that wonderful sort of almost smoky aroma of food that's been fast-fried in a wok. So I think if you have a gas cooker, that's already very helpful, and a traditional wok with a good seasoned surface. But I think one of the most important things is don't overload your wok, because you don't have the volcanic heat of a sort of professional Chinese kitchen. So you're working with a more modest heat source, even if you've got a gas burner. So I would always say don't put it, like if you're doing a chicken stir fry or something, don't put in too much food. Don't double up a recipe. And it enables you to create a high heat more easily. And the other thing is to start with a really hot wok. So that gives you a head start.
And how do you properly season the wok?
So with a traditional wok, you heat it with a little bit of oil and you swirl that oil all around the cooking surface of the wok until it's really smoky hot. And you pour that off and you add a little fresh oil for cooking. And then you have a non-stick seasoned surface for your wok.
Well, let's try that at home, folks. But we do have one more segment to go into discussion with Fuchsia Dunlop about the joys and delights of Sichuanese cuisine in particular. Her new book is The Food of Sichuan. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Fuchsia Dunlop. She's a James Beard Award-winning chef and writer, author of many books about Chinese cuisine. Her latest is The Food of Sichuan, and Sichuanese cuisine is her favorite from China. And before I get any further, everybody listening, you heard me ask for seconds on the fish-flavored eggplant dish that Fuchsia made. I had it. Because I wanted, I had seconds. Do you eat like this every day?
Quite a lot.
Because it tastes amazing. Really? I mean, like, it's just, I mean, it's a daily part of life for folks who live in Sichuan province, of course. But do you eat like this every day?
Yeah. A lot of Sichuanese food at home.
How long did it take you to make that in our kitchen here?
Oh, well, I pre-fried the aubergines, the eggplants in advance. So that takes a little bit of time. But actually making the dish, I don't know. 5 minutes?
Oh, come on. Okay, now I have no excuse. Now there are no excuses. Now, listen, you're getting a lot of comments online coming in. Jaso Turner says, oh man, I ate jiangbing in China and it was incredible. What's that?
Jiangbing is a sort of breakfast pancake in northern China with sort of crunchy things inside. It's very delicious.
Okay, well, Jaso Turner says it was one of the best foods I've ever eaten, just cooked on the side of the road by a lady and her daughter. Rod H. says, now I'm dying for some hot and sour soup. And Eric Baker says, I can confirm that the pepper is in fact amazing. I keep a constant supply. Goes perfectly in a spicy dish. Well, Fuchsia, if I may, I just want to play a moment from a 2019 Chinese food documentary series called Once Upon a Bite, where in this clip, we'll hear you speaking with a Chengdu vendor, asking the vendor for a particular local chili. Let's listen.
是不是这是啥子海椒？啥子海椒啊？啊，就是我们的四川的海椒噻。有没得那个二荆条？有二荆条，在哪里？
哦哟，香喷！Can you tell us a little bit about what you were asking for?
So I was asking for a particular local chili called Arjingtiao, which is a sort of long chili with a curved tail, which is not overpoweringly hot, but has a wonderful fragrance. And it's very good when pickled and used actually in fish fragrant dishes, or also pounded to a kind of coarse powder and then made into chili oil.
I see. Okay. And so this was a Chinese food documentary series that was it produced in China?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And broadcast in China?
Yes.
As well. And you were a best seller there as well.
Yeah. So I wrote a food memoir, sort of food and travel adventure story called Shark's Fin and Sichuan Pepper, a sweet sour memoir of eating in China. And that book was translated and published in mainland China last year. And yeah, it's been a big hit. And it's been such a surprise for me because I've always thought I'm writing for Westerners trying to explain Chinese cuisine. And now Chinese people are reading my books.
So can you explain? It was a surprise too, but a great surprise. But can you explain why you think the book caught on as it did in China?
Well, I think people are totally fascinated by a foreigner's view of Chinese cuisine. And they say to me that the things I notice about the way they eat are very different. So sort of aspects of Chinese life and gastronomy, they take for granted. It suddenly becomes interesting and noteworthy and surprising in the eyes of a foreigner. A lot of young Chinese people are very enraptured by my nostalgic descriptions of old Chengdu, because this is a sort of street life and a style of food that they've lost too. And so they find that very interesting. And I think also there's a curiosity value, you know, this crazy foreign woman who is quite serious about cooking Sichuanese food. So that's rather surprising for people too.
Well, Chinese television has done one, perhaps more profiles of you. And we have a clip of that here, where you're being introduced to a packed audience in a bookstore in Chengdu for signing the Chinese edition of Shark's Fin and Sichuan Pepper, as you just said. So let's listen to that. And there, the person introducing you is, or we hear them saying, the British girl in the book is Fuchsia, who's sitting among us. 20 years ago, she wandered through the streets and lanes of Chengdu. And then you introduced yourself there. They must appreciate your mastery of Chinese language.
Well, I mean, I think it's, yeah, people find it surprising that a foreigner speaks fairly fluent Chinese, and particularly that I can discuss sort of food and gastronomy in quite specialist detail, which is certainly unusual even for foreign Chinese speakers.
Well, let's go to Edward, who's calling from North Berwick, Maine. Edward, you're on the air.
Hello. What a great show. I'm starving now. I just wanted to ask about the comparison. In Western cultures, we pair food with wine. And I'm guessing in Cantonese cultures, specifically for the show, Sichuan, you know, cuisine, how do they pair food with sake?
I mean, traditionally, the Sichuanese would, if they were drinking alcohol with their food, they would drink these fairly strong grain spirits, baijiu. And also sort of more recently in informal meals, people like to drink beer. But in the last sort of 10 or 20 years, Chinese people and Sichuanese people are finding, you know, that grape wines from the West are accessible to them. And it's become kind of trendy. So Ganhong, dry red wine, was a favorite for many years, although it's not necessarily the best match for Chinese food. But the complicated thing about Chinese eating is that food is normally served family style. And you can imagine, particularly with Sichuanese cuisine, you have all these different diverse flavors going on at the same meal. So it's quite hard to think about it in the traditional Western way, about pairing a wine with a dish. So I think that, I mean, there are a couple of sort of general rules, which is that, you know, with Sichuanese food, classic matches include sort of aromatic, possibly faintly sweet white wines, but not oaky white wines. And if you want to drink red wine, not tannic wines. but you can't pair it dish by dish. And actually, in recent years, lots of the foodiest friends of mine in China are actually drinking whiskey with Sichuanese food.
Really?
And that's a really good match. Surprisingly excellent. So I think that'll fly in Sichuan.
Wow. You know, I'm just thinking back to something you said a couple of minutes ago, Fuchsia, where you were talking about how young Chinese who read your book and talk with you about your experiences in Chengdu from 25 years ago, connecting through you to a China they've never known, which is really, really interesting. I'm wondering, is there a push to preserve more formally the culinary heritage in different parts of China? I mean, I've heard about a debate over putting rules around how you make that certain Chinese pancake. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say it's quite complicated.
Okay.
So, for example, my old cooking school has been involved in an effort to sort of codify classic Sichuan recipes, like how to make the ultimate mapo tofu. And also, there's a huge interest in food tourism and food as culture and heritage. And so people like to go to small towns and have artisanal foods and traditional dishes. So, yes, there's a growing sense that food and food traditions are part of Chinese heritage and worth preserving. But on the downside, you know, young people are losing touch with the cooking skills of their parents and grandparents. So in the 1990s, all the elder generation were very great at cooking the traditional dishes, mapo tofu, fish fragrant eggplant, these kind of things. Not only that, they all made their own pickles and cured their winter meats. The younger generation hardly do this at all. So there's both an interest in preserving traditions and a practical kind of loss of culture and heritage, you know, in the practical sense.
Huh, interesting. Well, let's go to Eric, who's calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I mean, there's so many wonderful things you're talking about. It's hard to know where to begin. I'm a little biased because I lived in China for 20 years, and my wife is Chinese, and my son is half Chinese. We were absolutely indoctrinated into the wonderful food that families make there, you know, from your parents, your in-laws, your cousins. I mean, you just can't get enough of it. And it's not just Sichuan food. It's all kinds of regional cuisine in China. But the point I want to make is, coming back here to America recently, I'm seeing an explosion in the Midwest of a desire for non-traditional eating options. I mean, we've got enough Italian restaurants. We've got enough Mexican restaurants. That's enough. And people, I think, are really desiring something that's non-corporate, something that's not a chain. And Sichuan food is really hitting that note right now. And to see it happening in my hometown here in Oklahoma City is awesome. I mean, people are packing in the Chinese restaurants. And they're eating vegetables again. They're eating healthy again.
Yeah.
I mean, that's good.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for your call. Fuchsia, would you like to respond to him?
Yeah, well, one thing about vegetables, the Chinese are genius at making, like the eggplant dish, but all kinds of tasty vegetable dishes. And I also think that one of the wonderful aspects about Sichuanese food is that it doesn't have to be expensive. And you can go into the most humble noodle shop in Sichuan and have the best noodles you've ever had in your life. So it's because of this insistence on flavoring and not expensive ingredients. There is so much kind of accessible, easy, cheap street food and folk cooking. And I think you're right. There is a sort of people in the West are getting over that stereotype of Chinese food as being just Cantonese food and wanting the novelty of regional cuisines. And the other thing is that in a crowded marketplace, when you can go out for Korean or Japanese or Italian, Sichuanese really holds its own because of all the drama of flavors. It's very stimulating and electrifying. So even when competing with everything else, it's standing out there.
So I would like you to give us some insight. I mean, turnabout is fair play here. We've talked a lot about how in the West we've had this sort of rather flat view of what Chinese cuisine is for a long time. Is that same oversimplification happening when you talked with people in China when you were living there and how they viewed food of Europe or the United States?
Oh, totally.
I actually really love that.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hilarious. So a lot of Chinese people will make generalizations about something they call xicán, Western food. And the usual generalization is that it's 很简单, 很单调, which means that it's very simple and monotonous. So people, just as in the past, Westerners would judge Chinese cuisine by a deep fried takeout, Chinese people too often judge Western food by, like, you know, the fast food chains, and they think that's what everyone eats. But having said that, you know, in big cities like Shanghai and Beijing, there's more authentic Western food available and more Chinese people are traveling abroad. So I think on both sides, we're becoming a bit more open-minded.
We're all human in the end, right? So I just love how just on the other side of the mirror, it's the same thing going on here. Let's go to Pam, who's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Pam, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about MSG. I wonder what role MSG plays in Sichuan cooking and Chinese cooking in general. I mean, an understanding of it is that it's a flavor enhancer and that it's a natural derivative of seaweed. But personally, I have a bad allergic reaction every time I eat something with it. And I just wonder, I mean, with all these wonderful flavors that you're describing, if they do indeed use it, why would they use it when it doesn't seem like it would be necessary? Mm. I've spent time in Asia, not in China, but I've been in Nepal, and I've been to enough places to know that they use it very liberally, right, and they have just packages of it everywhere. And,
well,
I'm just wondering.
Yeah, Pam, let me let Fuchsia respond to that. Go ahead.
Yeah, so MSG is not a very traditional ingredient. It's only been around since 1908 and was only really widely used in Sichuan since about the 1960s. So it is a flavor enhancer. It's found naturally in Parmigiano cheese and seaweed and so on. But having said that, it's an absolutely valid question. With all those exciting flavors, why do you need MSG? And I never use it in my own cooking, and I don't think you need it. And I think that although I'm not opposed to MSG in principle, in some dishes it can add a little savory excitement. But I think that if you add MSG to everything, it kind of overhypes the sensations. And I prefer the natural flavors of the food. Mm. So, and with a dish like this, I mean, the fish fragrant eggplant, there's so much going on there. You don't need to give it another kick from MSG.
Not at all, says a novice consumer of that food. It was amazing as it was. Look, we have 2.5 minutes left to go, Fuchsia. So I've just got a couple questions that lean on your expertise here. We've obviously been focusing on Sichuanese cuisine here, but how would you characterize, you know, a couple of the other major regions of Chinese cuisine?
Well, China is a vast country, more of a continent than a country, and the regional diversity is extraordinary. So it's customary to talk about four great cuisines. So in the west, you have Sichuanese. In the south, you have Cantonese. In the north, you have Beijing or Shandong cooking, which is dominated by wheat products. So wonderful noodles and breads and dumplings, sort of vinegar and garlic and lamb and mutton meat. So these strong flavors. And then in the east, you have the Jiangnan region around Shanghai. Very delicate food, a little sweetness, soy sauce, lots of seafood and river delicacies. And that's another great cuisine. But if you want to go further into it, every province, practically every town has its own special realities.
And for the food of Sichuan, for folks who are listening who may have never tried to cook a dish, what would be your starter dish that you would recommend they first do, their first recipe?
Well, maybe you could do the cold dressed chicken. So it's a cooked chicken meat tossed in spicy seasonings. Very easy to make. Prepare it in advance. No stress. And it's really delicious.
Okay. So that's a quick and easy one. Does it require a lot of different ingredients?
No.
Okay, good. And now finally, before we go, again, people can't see this on the radio, but you've brought a knife that is like a cleaver here? What's so special? It looks like it's about half the size of an 8x10 sheet of paper. Hardened steel?
This is my Chinese cleaver. It's the ubiquitous Chinese kitchen knife. Looks very frightening often to Westerners. Looks like a butcher's chopper, but it's not. Have a hold. It's a very light knife, and I use it for everything from slicing a clove of garlic to cutting through a big hunk of meat.
Wow. No, it is very light. I thought it would actually be much, much heavier than this. Well, on that point, we will wrap up this conversation. The new book is The Food of Sichuan. It's by Fuchsia Dunlop. She is a James Beard Award-winning chef and writer. If you go to onpointradio.org, you can read a little bit from the book, and we've got a couple recipes as well, so definitely check it out. Fuchsia Dunlop, Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Mindy Luber, CEO of Ceres, a nonprofit dedicated to integrating sustainability into businesses. Here's host Kurt Nickisch.
Are the people who are working with ESG data now at companies, are they in a sustainability department? Does this just become part of general strategy or part of finance? How is that evolution happening with the actual people who are looking and working with the numbers?
So with both companies and investors, the cute idea of social responsibility that was at a manager level or something their foundations dealt with, that's gone. It is very clear based on data, based on facts, based on trends, that integrating sustainability into the core business is crucial. I mean, you cannot have a climate goal that says we're going to get to a net zero by 2040 if every department at the enterprise is not working on that. That's your manufacturing people. It's your supply chain people. So we find that there is often a sustainability team, but they're laying out a plan that involves almost every enterprise, every office, every part of a firm. And that's what we're seeing, because nobody can do the kind of cross-organizational work in one little group. It involves the entire team. It involves HR. Who are you hiring? Is DEI being implemented? How is that working? As it relates to where do you get your resources? Are there enough natural resources to make your product? What are the auto companies doing now that they've committed to by 2035, there will be no combustion engine vehicles coming off their assembly line for consumer vehicles? So sustainability is no longer a cute, a niche, a part of something off to the side. It is an integral part of almost every major enterprise and every major investor.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.